In the early 1950s, America was experiencing a literary transformation. The paperback revolution had democratized reading, bringing affordable books to drugstores, newsstands, and train stations across the nation. World War II had accelerated this trend, with the government producing low-cost books for homesick soldiers. By the time Patricia Highsmith, writing as Claire Morgan, published The Price of Salt in 1952, paperbacks had become a cultural phenomenon. The novel emerged during a time when lesbian-themed fiction was marketed primarily to titillate male readers with provocative covers featuring scantily clad women. Yet for isolated women across America, these books provided their first glimpse of shared experience. What made Highsmith's novel revolutionary wasn't just its subject matter, but its ending. Unlike other lesbian fiction of the era that invariably ended in tragedy, suicide, or conversion to heterosexuality, The Price of Salt dared to imagine the possibility of happiness for its characters. The book became an underground sensation, selling nearly a million copies and providing hope to countless readers who recognized themselves in its pages. The Frankenberg's department store cafeteria roars with a cacophony of holiday sounds as Therese Bellavette meticulously counts her cash drawer at the doll counter, her fingers trembling slightly from a mixture of fatigue and anxiety. The December air carries the artificial warmth of overworked heating systems, mingling with the scents of perfume and pine that define the Christmas shopping season. Waves of shoppers emerge from chrome-plated elevators with bewildered expressions, clutching their shopping lists and steering their children through the maze of holiday displays. From her strategic position behind the counter, Therese observes the stark social divisions playing out before her. Wealthy women wrapped in plush mink coats breeze through, barely glancing at price tags as they hastily purchase expensive dolls with painted porcelain faces. In sharp contrast, working-class families linger longingly before the display cases, parents quietly calculating figures in their heads before regretfully steering their disappointed children away from $13.50 toys, a sum representing several days' wages for many. The inequity gnaws at Therese, and she often finds herself wishing she could simply distribute the dolls to those who need them most, particularly when she sees the crestfallen expressions of children pressed against the glass cases. One evening after her shift ends, Therese encounters Mrs. Robashek, a worn-looking woman from the sweater department whose hunched shoulders and tired eyes speak of decades of retail work. Despite Therese's initial reluctance and Mrs. Robashek's matter-of-fact demeanor, the older woman extends an unexpected dinner invitation to her apartment. What begins as a simple act of kindness transforms into an increasingly unsettling experience as Therese steps into Mrs. Robashek's dim, cluttered apartment, a physical manifestation of faded dreams and diminished expectations. The musty air and yellowing wallpaper seem to close in around her as Mrs. Robashek reveals fragments of her past life as a dress shop owner, now reduced to selling sweaters to make ends meet. The evening reaches its crescendo when Mrs. Robashek persuades Therese to try on a garnet red velvet dress, a relic from her former design shop. Standing before a spotted mirror in the aging garment, Therese experiences a near-fainting spell, overwhelmed by claustrophobic terror. The dress becomes a symbol of potential futures, of dreams deferred and lives spent in quiet desperation. The possibility that she too might end up trapped in such a life, surrounded by the ghosts of former ambitions, sends a cold shiver through her body. Days later, while mechanically assisting customers at her counter, Therese's world shifts on its axis when she helps a tall, elegant blonde woman whose penetrating gray eyes seem to see straight through her carefully maintained professional facade. The woman carries herself with natural grace and self-assurance, selecting a valise and a doll with deliberate care. She signs her purchase as Mrs. H.F. Aird, and something in her presence, perhaps the subtle curve of her smile or the gentle authority in her voice, awakens something previously dormant in Therese. acting on an impulse she doesn't fully understand, Therese later sends her a Christmas card, carefully including her employee number. When Mrs. Aird calls the next day to thank her for the unexpected gesture and suggests meeting for lunch, Therese accepts with an eagerness that surprises her, even as she grapples with the unfamiliar emotion stirring within her chest. In a quiet restaurant with wooden rafters, Carol Aird orders old fashions and observes that Therese must be new to Frankenberg's. Therese finds herself captivated by everything about Carol. Her pearl earrings, her golden lipstick case, her gray eyes flickering over her like fire. When Carol asks about her background, Therese shares her life story in 6 sentences, feeling none of it matters anymore because she was happy now, starting today. Carol pronounces Therese's name the French way, Therese, which Therese loves. When Carol invites her to visit her country home that Sunday, Therese immediately accepts, her heart racing at the prospect. Meanwhile, Therese struggles with her relationship with Richard Semko, knowing she isn't in love with him. When Richard presses her about her feelings, she admits she likes him but doesn't love him. He asks to stay the night, but Therese refuses, remembering their previous uncomfortable sexual encounters. She abruptly tells him she can't go to Europe with him either because she doesn't want to sleep with him. Though Richard laughs it off, the conversation ends painfully, with his understanding tolerance only increasing Therese's shame. The Sunday visit to Carol's elegant 2-story house is filled with tension and unspoken feelings. Therese plays Scarlatti on the piano, but stops abruptly, overwhelmed by emotions. Carol leads her upstairs for a nap, asking her age and calling her a child when Therese answers 19. After bringing hot milk that has boiled over, Carol listens as tearfully reveals her past, her father's death, her mother abandoning her at a boarding school, and her deliberate estrangement from her mother. Their intimate moment is interrupted by the unexpected arrival of Carol's husband, Harge, who coldly retrieves some items for their daughter, Rindy. Therese makes a significant sacrifice by pawning her cherished silver St. Christopher medallion, a meaningful gift from Richard that symbolized their connection, to purchase an expensive black handbag with distinctive gold buckles that reminded her powerfully of Carol. The decision marks a subtle shift in her emotional allegiances, trading a token of her relationship with Richard for something that connects her to Carol. On her final day working at Frankenberg's department store on Christmas Eve, her heart leaps at receiving an unexpected telegram from Carol requesting to meet. Their subsequent encounter reveals Carol in a vulnerable state, clearly struggling with the emotional weight of her impending divorce from Hark. Despite Carol's melancholy, they share an intimate evening together, driving through the quiet streets to select a Christmas tree. The ritual of decorating the tree at Carol's house becomes almost magical, with both women losing track of time as they arrange ornaments and lights until well past midnight. Therese, caught in the spell of the moment, abandons her predetermined Christmas plans with Richard without hesitation, a decision that feels both natural and momentous. The peaceful bubble of their evening together bursts early the next morning when Therese is startled awake by whistling outside. Through the window, she observes a scene that stirs complex emotions. Carol engaged in animated conversation with a woman in an open-topped car, Abby Gerhardt, Carol's longtime friend. The easy intimacy between Carol and Abby is immediately apparent, triggering waves of jealousy in Therese. Their comfortable shorthand and shared history become painfully evident during breakfast, where the conversation inevitably turns to Carol's divorce proceedings. The revelation that Carol will be separated from her daughter Rindy for 3 months adds another layer of complexity to the already complicated situation. Christmas Day finds Therese surrounded by the warmth and chaos of Richard's Russian family celebration. Yet she feels strangely distant, her thoughts constantly drifting to Carol. In a moment heavy with symbolism, beneath a beaded ornament said to possess wish-granting powers, Richard prompts Therese to make a wish. Her silent prayer for Carol reveals the true direction of her heart. Later, while watching a handmade kite soar against the winter sky, a gift from Richard that should represent their connection, Therese cautiously broaches the subject of same-sex attraction. Richard's dismissive response, suggesting such feelings always stem from some underlying psychological cause or trauma, highlights the gulf widening between them. Thérèse finds herself in a peculiar emotional state, experiencing a happiness more profound than any she's known before, yet unable to share or explain its source to Richard, who has always been her confidant. This disconnect marks the beginning of their inevitable drift apart, as Thérèse's authentic self begins to emerge from behind the facade of their conventional relationship. Carol calls Thérèse with an unexpected invitation to Chinatown, replacing the fabricated Christmas benefit party Thérèse had invented as an excuse to Richard. Before departing, Thérèse's mounting frustration with Richard reaches a breaking point. His presumptuous behavior, casually arranging their future together, speaking of their relationship as an inevitability, grates against her growing sense of independence. Though she asks him to leave, a gesture of lingering affection prompts her to give him the carefully chosen Degas book from Frankenberg's, highlighting the complex nature of their unraveling relationship. The evening unfolds at the elegant St. Regis, where Carol is sharing drinks with Stanley McVeigh, a handsome, sophisticated man she introduces with calculated casualness as an old friend. The description carries undertones of past intimacy that Thérèse can't help but notice. Their subsequent adventure in Chinatown becomes a sensory feast of exotic sights and experiences, with both women delighting in the discovery of unusual gifts. When Thérèse insists on buying Carol an exquisite pair of sandals, Carol's initial protests give way to a touched acceptance, marking a subtle shift in their dynamic from admirer and admired to something more reciprocal. Professionally, Thérèse's career shows promising momentum. Mr. Balton, whose credentials as a Russian Academy graduate carry significant weight in theater circles, takes notice of her talent and recommends her for an assistant position. This leads to Mr. Andronich offering her a coveted 2-week engagement in Philadelphia for mid-February, a potential stepping stone to bigger opportunities. Yet these career advances feel secondary to Thérèse, whose thoughts invariably circle back to Carol with magnetic persistence. The lunch meeting with Abby introduces a new tension to Thérèse's world. Their interaction becomes an intricate dance of unspoken competition, with both women acutely aware of their shared devotion to Carol. Abby's questioning takes on an almost interrogative quality, while she remains deliberately opaque about her own relationship with Carol. Thérèse, sensing the undercurrent of rivalry, carefully measures her responses about meeting Carol, protecting these precious memories from scrutiny. Abby's warnings about Carol's vulnerable state, her loneliness, and numerous worries carry both genuine concern and subtle territorial marking. The revelation about Carol's planned trip with Thérèse lands with calculated impact, information Abby knowingly delivers before Carol herself has mentioned it, asserting her insider status while simultaneously opening new possibilities for Thérèse's relationship with Carol. After her unsettling lunch with Abby, Thérèse feels angry and confused about Carol's relationship with her friend. When Carol casually invites Thérèse to join her on a 3-week trip, Thérèse initially declines, hurt that Carol had mentioned it to Abby first. Carol explains that Abby is an old friend she talks everything over with, but this doesn't ease Thérèse's resentment. Richard confronts Thérèse directly. "Why do you like her so much?" They sit in a pink-walled cafeteria on Lexington Avenue, where Richard accuses her of having a hell of a crush on Carol, dismissing it as something schoolgirlish that Carol was indulging for her own amusement. Phrases from an unsent letter to Carol float through Thérèse's mind. "I feel I stand in a desert with my hands outstretched, and you are raining down upon me." Their argument deepens as Thérèse questions why Richard thinks he likes her at all. She tells him bluntly he will never be a good painter and will eventually work for his father as expected. In a moment of sudden emotion, Thérèse deliberately smashes the Madonna figurine Richard had given her. Later at Carol's house, Carol questions her about the conversation with Richard, surprisingly concerned about his feelings. "You're not used to thinking of other people's feelings," Carol tells her bluntly. When Therese explained she had said goodbye to Richard, Carol becomes upset that she had mentioned Carol's name, comparing their situation to a classic play with predictable roles. As they prepare to embark on their westward journey, Therese experiences a complex mix of emotions, burning excitement tempered by an undercurrent of nervous anticipation. The open road beckons with promise, yet she can't shake the feeling that this journey will irrevocably alter her life's trajectory. Their first significant stop in Defiance, Ohio, proves pivotal as they spend an evening wandering through tree-lined residential streets, their footsteps echoing in the winter quiet. Here, Carol finally unveils the painful intricacies of her marriage to Harg, describing years of subtle power plays and emotional warfare that gradually eroded their relationship into a cycle of spite and retaliation. Chicago marks their first taste of shared luxury at the Drake Hotel, its Art Deco elegance providing a fitting backdrop for their deepening connection. Carol chooses to wear the same black suit she wore during their first lunch at Frankenberg's, a detail that doesn't escape Therese's notice. Over an elaborate dinner accompanied by flowing champagne, Therese finally voices the words that have been building inside her for weeks: "Carol, I love you." The confession emerges naturally, almost inevitably, and Carol's response, a tender kiss and reciprocal declaration, feels like the culmination of everything that's been unspoken between them. Their arrival in Waterloo, Iowa, becomes a watershed moment. In a modest hotel room that will forever be etched in Therese's memory, they share a bed for the first time. The dawn light filtering through thin curtains witnesses their first intimate encounter, a moment Therese experiences as both revelation and homecoming. Every detail burns itself into her consciousness: the pattern of shadows on the wall, the texture of the sheets, the way Carol's voice sounds when she whispers, "My angel," flung out of space. The phrase becomes a talisman, carrying all the weight of their shared discovery. The world takes on a dreamlike quality for Therese in the aftermath. Mundane tasks like purchasing newspapers or ordering coffee feel surreal, as if she's experiencing everything through a new lens. That evening, seeking to understand Carol more deeply, Therese broaches the subject of Abby. Carol's explanation reveals a relationship rooted in decades of friendship, which briefly blossomed into romance during their furniture business venture. The affair lasted only 2 months, ending naturally before Carol met Therese, but the friendship endured. This revelation helps Therese understand both Carol's past and the depth of their current connection, confirming that what they share is something entirely new and profound for both of them. Carol and Therese travel westward through America's heartland, experiencing moments of perfect happiness. In Sioux Falls, they discover a one-ring circus where Carol is gifted posters she later sends to Abby and Rindy. That evening feels magical to Therese, who confesses she no longer feels the urge to create anything because she's found what she'd been seeking all along: happiness with Carol. Their idyll is shattered when Carol receives mysterious telegrams that visibly disturb her. After making urgent phone calls, Carol reveals the truth. Harge has hired a detective to follow them since Chicago, gathering evidence to use against Carol in a custody battle for Rindy. Though Therese offers to leave to protect Carol, Carol refuses to be separated, saying firmly, "I want you with me." When the detective's black sedan appears behind them again, Carol decides to confront him. She pulls alongside his car and demands to know why he is following them. "I'm doing my job, Mrs. Aird," he replies with mechanical detachment. He warns that Carol should return to New York, ominously stating that her child is at stake. Carol angrily insists, "My child is my property," to which the detective coldly responds, "A human being is not property." The encounter leaves Therese with a crushing realization. The whole world was ready to be their enemy. And suddenly what she and Carol had together seemed no longer love or anything happy, but a monster between them, with each of them caught in a fist. Carol's return to New Jersey marks the beginning of an agonizing period of separation that profoundly affects both women. While Therese remains stranded in Sioux Falls, she attempts to maintain some semblance of normalcy through various distractions, immersing herself in set model construction, attending local motorcycle races at the fairgrounds, and spending long hours at the public library. Yet these activities only serve to highlight Carol's absence, as each passing day deepens Therese's sense of isolation and mounting anxiety. Their once intimate communications grow increasingly tense and sporadic. Carol's letters, when they come, are weighted with the gravity of her escalating legal battle with Harge over Rindy's custody. The situation takes a devastating turn when Carol reveals that Florence, her trusted maid of several years, has betrayed them by selling Therese's personal letter to Harge, transforming their private correspondence into ammunition in the custody dispute. This betrayal adds another layer of pain to their forced separation and demonstrates how their relationship has become vulnerable to external threats. When Carol finally sends Therese money for a flight back to New York, the gesture comes with an ominous undertone. Something significant has occurred that makes their planned reunion impossible. Desperate for clarity, Therese makes a crucial phone call to Carol, only to receive news that shatters her world. Carol has capitulated in the custody battle, accepting a devil's bargain that requires her to permanently sever ties with Therese in exchange for limited visitation rights with Rindy. The choice between her daughter and her lover becomes an impossible sacrifice that reshapes both their lives. In the aftermath of this revelation, Therese finds herself emotionally adrift. The city becomes a maze of painful memories. She cannot bring herself to enter restaurants, shops, or streets that remind her of Carol. Seeking escape through work rather than succumb to grief in anonymous hotel rooms, she takes a position at a lumber yard, earning $40 per week, a job as far removed from her theatrical aspirations as possible. When Abby eventually reaches out, her call brings news that Carol has fallen ill in Vermont, along with pointed criticism of Therese's silence. Abby's harsh words suggest that Therese bears some responsibility for the detective's involvement, adding guilt to her already overwhelming emotional burden. This period of separation becomes a crucible of transformation for both women, testing their resilience and forcing them to confront the real-world consequences of their relationship. Returning to her old room in New York, Therese notices the carpet corner now lies flat. The space feels both tragic and intimately familiar. She withdraws money from her dwindling savings to buy a black dress and shoes, symbolically shedding her juvenile wardrobe and past. Meeting Carol at the Ritz Tower, Therese feels changed. Carol notices immediately, commenting on her grown-up appearance. Carol reveals she's lost custody of Rindy almost completely due to refusing Harvey's demands. She's selling the house, taking an apartment on Madison Avenue, and starting a job as a furniture buyer. When Carol asks Therese to live with her, Therese hesitates, feeling balanced on a thin edge between Carol and an empty question mark, ultimately declining despite her conflicted feelings. At a cocktail party for English actress Genevieve Crennel, Therese meets Harkavy, who offers her work. Genevieve invites Therese to a private party in her suite, clearly interested in her. Though flattered, Therese suddenly realizes Genevieve will never mean anything to her beyond this encounter. A feeling of tragedy fills her, as she understands she could pursue something with Genevieve, but never would. Declining the actress's invitation, Therese leaves abruptly, running toward the LSE, where Carol is meeting someone. Standing in the doorway, she watches Carol, recognizing that she loves and will always love her, in 1,000 cities, 1,000 houses, in foreign lands where they would go together, in heaven and in hell. When Carol finally notices her, she smiles and waves eagerly as Therese walks toward her, choosing love despite all the obstacles they faced and will continue to face in a world not yet ready to accept them.